Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome to Nerds Podcast number 378. I think there might be just a few tickets left for the Nerds Podcast at San Diego Comic-Con. If you go to nerds.com/calendar, you can find the link there. We have a very special guest who we will be able to announce in the coming days, but you will like the guest a lot. So please go grab some tickets. I'm going to be moderating a bunch of panels. I'll announce that too. It's really a lot of stuff I can't announce yet, Katie. Why am I even talking about things? Here's some stuff that I can't tell you about. Hey, here's a thing, but I can't tell you exactly what it is. I apologize for the veil of secrecy. But soon, all answers will be revealed. Go to Nerdist.com or Nerdist.com/calendar. Or follow on Facebook, Nerdist. Instagram, Nerdist. Twitter, Nerdist. Google Plus, Nerdist. It's everything. There's even some beta social networks where I parked that shit, Katie. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode. Katie's sitting right here, by the way. I didn't think your name was Katie, the listener. And if your name is Katie, then there is probably a sliver of poop in your underwear from hearing me shout your name at you. But hopefully that's not the case. Clean up your underwear, Katie. I was actually talking to Katie in the studio over here. Come on, Katie.
Sorry.
Oh, man. This episode of the Nerds Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom. Inventors, entrepreneurs, you guys need to protect your stuff. Protect your intellectual property, or IP, as the kids call it right now. Yeah, kids use terms like IP now. Register your trademark, protect your products and services, incorporate or form an LLC, and launch your dream business. Just visit LegalZoom.com. They're going to take care of you from start to finish. They've already helped out about 1 million businesses get started right. Celebrate innovation with LegalZoom. For a limited time, get a special price on trademark and copyright applications by using the referral code Nerdist at checkout. Protect your creations and launch your dream at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom can provide self-help services at your specific direction, or they can connect you to an attorney, but please note they are not a law firm. Don't forget to use the referral code Nerdist at LegalZoom.com. This episode is Randy Pitchford, who is president and one of the co-founders of Gearbox Software, which is a company, among other things, that made expansion packs for Half-Life. They made Brothers in Arms, Borderlands 1 and 2. And Randy and I met when I hosted the DICE Awards this year. He turned out to be a super cool guy, and this chat was a blast, because I said, look, if you're ever in Los Angeles, let me know what happened to the podcast, and he was. And so this was the result. But I absolutely love hearing someone who is not only incredibly knowledgeable, but also really passionate about what they make. And, you know, this is a guy who does what anyone should do, which is he loved something and made a career out of it. And this was the week before E3 that we recorded this. So there, you know, if you're like, how come they didn't talk about the controversy? I don't know if that's how you talk, but let's just
in my head, that's how you talk. And so that's why it hadn't happened yet. So this was recorded May 31st and then got bumped a few weeks because a bunch of people had podcasts that were very time sensitive and had to go up to promote things. So this was the soonest that I could get it up, and I put it up as soon as possible. And then also in a week or two, I'll put up Ken Levine, who I just love talking to gaming software guys. So here we go. Nerds Podcast number 378 with Randy Pitchford. Hashtag boner farts.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome. Randy Pitchford, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
It's good to see you, and I'm glad this actually worked out because we chatted when I hosted the Dice Awards.
That's right.
And I was like, come on the podcast. And you were like, all right.
Who won Best Andrew Dice Clay this year?
It was actually Andrew Dice Clay took it again.
Oh, God. Every year, this guy.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bummer.
It is. It almost went to the guy who played Turtle, and then
also Susan Lucci was nominated
again, but never won.
Jerry Ferrara has a name, sir.
I'm sorry. Where do you live? Where's Gearbox?
I live in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, you are in Dallas.
Plano. It's a suburb of Dallas.
Dallas is a collection of a lot of suburbs, it seems like, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think anyone actually lives in the city.
Is there? Has anyone ever actually been? Have you actually been to Dallas? Could you define Dallas?
All we know about Dallas is JFK went there and never came back, right?
That's the one thing that
so
people
we don't
are
go
sure
downtown.
About. LA's the same way. There's not really a...
Yeah, Robert Kennedy went here and never came back.
Oh, no.
There's not really a...
There's a theme here.
Yeah. It's like a Bermuda Triangle of politicians.
With 2 points, so
yeah.
It's more like a Bermuda line.
If you work
line.
In any other sector, you're fine.
It's the Bermuda line.
Yeah, it's right there. Everything's fine. But, okay, so you guys are based out of Texas.
Yes. Yeah, but I lived here. I lived in L.A.
Didn't you go to UCLA?
I did.
So did I.
Right on. Look at that. Yeah, I didn't care anything about like being a Bruin. I just, you know, was going to school. So.
You were just, yeah, just going to school.
Yeah, like people, like sometimes like USP people come up to me, they're like, "Arr," and I'm like, dude, I don't care.
Oh, USC? I'm the exact same
like,
way.
I don't really care about any
don't
of that.
Talk to this guy. He's a Trojan. I'm like, I don't, okay.
Whatever.
It doesn't make a difference.
Grr. You curses.
Exactly. Some people got really into it, though.
You go, oh, yes, they did.
Because they have nothing else. They have nothing else.
You know, my mom would always say to me, like, aren't you going to go to the game? And I'm like, which game?
I didn't go to a single game.
And she'd be like, have some pride. Like, I never even knew what... I was like, is it basketball?
Yeah,
or is it? She was like, it's football. Have some pride.
Exactly.
Like, I do have pride. It's just not in...
UCLA
know.
Is more college basketball known.
Yeah.
John Wooden. Never
sure.
mind. Forget it.
No, I know
sports
that.
Guys.
I know that name.
All right, good.
Yeah,
good.
The John Wooden Center.
Okay, well,
he's named after him. Did you graduate? Did you go there?
No, I am not a graduate. I went to the real world before getting a degree. So.
You were, which one? New York? San Francisco?
San Francisco, Miami, Cancun. What did you study at UCLA?
I was going to study law, and then my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, helped me realize that is absolutely not what I should be doing, that I was built to entertain people. So I spent all my time at home with my computer, and she kind of said, hey, you should probably do something with that, and she was right.
And it worked out okay.
Yeah.
It seems
to have worked out
all right.
I was actually performing as a magician at the Magic Castle at Wizard, so that's how I made money when I was going to school, and I always liked, you know, entertaining people. But with video games, it's awesome because I can make like one thing and reach like zillions of people, whereas like with Magic, I can only entertain as the number of people that are like in the room.
Well, you know? Video games
it's
are sort
like
of
podcast.
Like
cast,
and then with close-up magic, it's just like,
that's my favorite stuff. That's my favorite.
But
stuff.
But video games are like parlor magic, but also close-up magic.
Exactly.
At the same
You're
time.
Right. Yeah.
There's a
lot of the
I think
similar...
that was a bit of a stretch.
No. Well, or was
you.
It a sleight of hand?
Thank you for pointing out the obvious, Jonah.
I like the Job gestures.
Yeah, I did a little. I did a little
that's
magic.
That's what magic is.
Are you watching Arrested?
Yeah. In fact, we watched all three seasons. Just like we did a marathon back to back before, you know, the Saturday or Sunday or whenever.
Now, how do you have time to do that? What with Gearbox?
Dude,
and
when I'm like. Friday evening, I come home, and like from Friday evening until Monday morning, all I do is sit on my ass in my pajamas, consuming content, playing video games.
You hear that, Chris?
That's great.
That's a lot.
It's a weekend. It's a time to just relax. It's a day off.
Just sit on my ass and watch things and play with things and.
Oh man, that sounds
toys
awesome.
And read stuff and yeah, it's pretty
possible.
Cool.
What have you been playing lately?
Oh, dude. Well, which platform?
Xbox. We've been playing on Xbox.
Let's see. Been playing. I played Bioshock Infinite.
Nice, me too.
I played. I was playing Assassin's Creed 3. I haven't finished it yet, so I'm kind of bouncing back in and
me
out.
Me either. For
that.
Some reason, I cannot.
It's weird. It's
that
like
game.
They took some of the Assassin's Creed out of Assassin's Creed.
Yeah.
And it's neat. It's beautiful, and it's an amazing setting. And
I enjoy walking around the streets
there,
and going, "That's correct. That's correct. Good job."
Yeah.
You watch it. Like, it's like the History Channel. Yeah. For Yeah. But I loved. I thought Bioshock was really, was real.
Ken nailed it. It was awesome. Well, what's interesting for me is I played it around October, November. Ken asked me to come up and play through it just
sure.
to give him notes.
Sure.
And it was awesome. And then it's really interesting to get that double tap to see what the final release product right is like and see all the differences and the subtleties and stuff. And there's a few differences. It was cool.
I talked to him when I was midway through the game. And he was like, I was close to the ending. And he goes, okay, you're either going to hate me after you see the ending or you're going to think it's the greatest thing you've ever seen. And I thought the ending, I'm not going to give
brilliant.
It away. I thought it was fucking fantastic.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Do those things have to be mutually exclusive, though?
Yeah.
Can't you enjoy the ending and also hate them?
But I really like the end of it a lot.
Because
I really felt like the whole time I was like, how is this going to... And which is what I think is not just with video games, but with any medium where they start throwing out these really big concepts during the whatever it is, the game or the show or the movie. And many times they just don't tie it up. They're like, it's Chad, you know. But I really feel like they did a good job.
It's interesting. They simultaneously tied it up and then they also kind of created this. Like I told Ken, it's like, man, now somebody's gonna have to make like 1,000 different Bioshock games. Like
you could,
yeah, right. Like so, or you could just never make another one again. Like either is an acceptable kind of future. But those are the only two futures. Like there can either be 1,000 Bioshocks or none ever again. There's no like single sequel possible.
Is it this sort of kind of fraternity of developers where you guys all?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd call it a fraternity. There's no official club, but yeah, there's a lot of us that have developed, you know, a lot of respect and we know each other and some of us have grown up together in this industry, right? So we kind of trust each other. Like, for example, every single game, I think, in the entire last generation that either Epic made or the Gearbox game, like Cliffy and I would go back and play each other's games and give each other notes and stuff. And we got a lot of value out of that. And I think it was actually Rod up at Irrational that was kind of whispering in Ken's ear, like, hey, you should, you know... We used to do this with Randy a lot, and we get some good notes out of it. So give it a shot.
That's cool. What was your first? Did you grow up playing arcade games, console games, or like did you like text based PC games?
Everything.
Yeah,
I think it was the text based PC games that kind of turned me into a game maker.
Zork.
Actually, before that, Colossal Cave, which was the Colossal Cave Adventure, was like the inspiration for Zork. Zork was basically like a clone or a copy of Colossal Cave Adventures. I don't know if you've ever played.
I don't think I played Colossal Cave. I loved the shit out of Zork.
You're standing at the end of a small road in front of a red brick building, and you know north, you know, or
right.
enter build. You know, it's the same kind of deal, and it's a fantasy kind of universe, and the goal is to dive into this dungeon and collect all the treasure and bring it back to the house. Simple.
And what I feel like, and certainly what I feel like you guys have managed to do, and then come, and also like Gabe and Valve, and is I loved that there was sort of like a, I don't know how to describe it, but just like a sort of a snarky nerdiness to the all those original, like even like the original D&D books. There was almost a little bit of an acknowledgement to the user, like a little bit of a
sometimes
wink
and some
snark.
Fourth wall breaking.
Exactly.
In pen and paper form, yeah.
Yeah, and you sort of, you know, that's when it sort of spoke to me the most. I'm like, oh, these guys who are making this, they are me. They are like
dude,
me.
If you like that kind of stuff, the next DLC that's coming out for Borderlands 2, it's called Tiny Tina's Assault on Dragon's Keep, and the whole premise is Tiny Tina is running basically a D&D game. She calls it Bunkers and Badasses, and the characters in Borderlands are players, so when you're playing the game, she'll be like, and then a giant dragon comes and like, you know, it just kills everybody at the beginning. And they're like, dude, you can't create an impossible boss monster in the first, you know, and all the characters start bitching. She says, okay, forget it. And she'll, like, bring everybody back to life, remove the boss monster, and, like, replace it. And now it's a skeleton guy thing, you know, and then this other thing appears, and other characters will say, like, I should totally be in this adventure, and then it'll just swap out in front of you. Like, you know, there's this one part where you go into this forest, and it's like, you know, she says, like, it's the fantastical forest. It's all, like, dark and dreary. It's like, this doesn't look right, Tina. It needs to be, and, like, and instantly it changes into, you know, it's like she's narrating and playing the dungeon master, and the game is changing in real time based
that.
On that. It's pretty meta. There's a whole bunch of fun. We play with that premise that you were just talking about to the nth degree in this.
Well, yeah. That's what my, because my girlfriend, who's a huge, is fucking a massive video game.
Awesome.
I like her. she actually cosplayed as Gage. Like, she made this insane.
Oh, dude, I should see. Send us a picture of that.
I will.
Send it around to our fans, because
she
love
built
that
a
kind of
fucking
stuff.
Foam robot.
Hell yeah.
It's crazy. I'll show you. I'll show it to you before.
That's
before you leave.
Sick. That's awesome.
But, you know, one of the things that she, you know, because she loves to talk about this stuff, and she was like, please express the idea that what I love about Borderlands was that it sort of brought this kind of an informality to and a looseness with the player, you know, where you sort of felt like you were part of it.
Yeah,
somehow.
We definitely wink a lot, and Anthony's amazing at that. He's the author, you know, the lead writer for Borderlands 2, and he's I don't know if you know Anthony Birch. He has a web show called Hey Ash, What You Playing? Have you guys ever seen that?
I've not seen that.
Oh, let's check it out. It's pretty good. It's a little thing he did for a while when he was a Destructoid, and it's pretty self-aware, and it's got all those, you know, nod at the. You know, because video games are stupid, right? Like, they're just like, we do so many silly things that you just can never get away with. But we, you know, there's excuses because it's a video game. So he kind of plays with a lot of those premises in his work, and you feel it in Borderlands.
Well, that's kind of the, that's sort of the John Kricfalusi idea of cartoons, where it's like, it's a cartoon, fucking play with it.
That's right.
Like, don't take it so seriously, you know?
Sometimes games try to, like, excuse all the gameisms, you know, they like try to create constructs that, oh, this is why it's a gameism, you know, and but like Borderlands just didn't give a fuck. It actually embraced it and amplified all that stuff.
Well, here's where there's a collective scream at me, at the audience, which is I have not played Borderlands.
What?
But I could pretend like I did, but I don't do that.
And your girlfriend has, and
she
it's
played
like,
the shit out of it, and I watched
it's like
her
the
play
best co-op game ever. You guys should be playing together.
Well, okay, that's a whole other issue. Like, that's a whole other thing that
you don't have time for games anymore,
with the relationship,
right?
Or with the game.
God, if we could just learn to work together. Here's the thing, I had quit playing. Video. I was like addicted, video game addict. From,
oh, okay. So you're recovering.
From, yeah, like seriously,
you
from
let it go too far.
From
moderation,
late,
sir.
Late '70s until about 2003.
Okay.
Like I was a kind of like I'm skipping class to play. You know, like
oh,
I would skip class so I could burn through Super Mario 3, or okay. I would skip auditions so I could
so
get
you've
through
got a problem.
GTA or yeah or Wild Arms or any of those. I loved like big RPG games and like 40-hour games. And so I quit for like 5 years. But what happened is with Nerdist, when I started getting busier, and I mean, obviously because when I worked at G4, you know, we were covering E3, and I was like, I can't not play games if I'm working at G4. And so it was a fun. It was one of the things in, you know, 2008 for me was that I had a reason. I was like, well, now I have to play again, you know, because it's work.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I started playing again, but. With Nerdist, I had gotten so busy in the last year and a half that, you know, I would have maybe just a little bit of time each night to play something, and I got really obsessed about Skyrim for a while.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Well, just because it's such a – it was like, oh, here's an epic –
that's a great game.
Here's
an
epic – you know, I played the game for hundreds of hours and exhausted pretty much every quest, and so I just didn't have – I'm just getting to a point now where it's like you said – oh, I actually have like a little bit of chunk of free time here and there because some things are up and running.
So you are an addict. Like you get into Skyrim and you can't just sample it. You just have to.
Chloe got so mad at me, especially when she was playing through Borderlands 2 and she was like, you fucking moron. This is the fucking one of the greatest games ever. And you're still.
If you like Skyrim.
And you're still playing Skyrim.
You wouldn't
and
like
I was like,
Borderlands 2.
I know, but I just want to get to level 50.
Like shooters. If you also like shooters like Bioshock, like.
Yeah.
It's like the perfect amalgamation.
Well, I watched her play and a game like Borderlands instantly appeals to me because it's funny and because, you know, of things like boner farts.
It's funny?
Yeah. Like boner farts.
I'm glad to... boner farts, yeah.
That's funny.
It's, you know, it's one of our proudest moments. the boner farts moment. Yeah.
So when you're, how much of a hand do you have in the? Do you consult on it? Like when you have a bunch of games that you guys are making, are you in essence a consultant, or do you just sort of focus in on one thing?
It depends on the game. I'm part of a group of people that are driving and conceiving everything. So I tend to be part of the ground floor of everything that we do. I mean, it's just the nature of my position. I started in this industry as a programmer, and then I became a designer. So I'm a craftsman. Like, I got in the industry to build games. So I'll tend to pick up a task or two that I'm actually in the critical path on everything we do. But that said, there are, there's 200 people at my studio, and there's an incredible talent. So, there's a whole lot of folks that make what we do, and everyone's, especially with a game like Borderlands, which just affords creativity from every direction, right? Some designer will have some crazy idea and it's like, dude, run with that. Make that happen and realize that in our space. And, everybody kind of has learned what works and what doesn't. So there doesn't have to be a lot of, totalitarian oversight for consistency. It's a game that's perfect for, going wild with. So it's everything in there is a consequence of a team thing. Like the boner farts thing, like there was a whiteboard of, I gotta name this thing, just whiteboard of all these random stupid things, and people started calling out dumb shit, and boner farts one of them. So Anthony and Paul and the designers made a quest out of naming one of the monsters and going through all the different names, including, hey, we're gonna name that monster boner farts. If you haven't played it yourself, it's, I'm just saying the word boner farts, and that alone is going to have to carry the joke.
But also we'll make people play the game to figure out where that happens.
Sure, sure. It's definitely a meta kind of moment. There's this character, Sir Hammerlock, who's kind of like, this Livingston kind of explorer, safari kind of guy, and he's, classifying the xenofauna on Pandora and naming the creatures, and he's trying to come up with a name for this thing that's ultimately called a bullymong, and he's going through all these different names, and you have to go out and help him with this, and it's silly.
I watch her play a lot of the game.
Okay, so it's almost as good.
It's not like I'm unfamiliar with it. Not like, tell me about this Borderlands.
Yeah, fair enough.
And I think, and certainly when she talks about games, and she's pretty passionate about, when people are like, oh, there's video game violence. And she was like, no. In a game like Borderlands, the teamwork aspect,
yeah,
it, she feels is more valuable than, but there's guns. They're like, no, but before, okay, that's just it's a game.
Sure.
But it actually forces people to work together. There's like the co-op aspect is really where you get a totally different experience.
Yeah, we did. We sold a game under the premise of 87 bazillion guns, So like, yeah, so it, the reality is we created, on one level, everyone knows what a gun does, right? So as a game design trope, it's one of the easiest tools in the universe, right? You got to put a gun in somebody's hands, like, oh, I point at something, pull the trigger, and now I understand the game loop, right? It's simple. You don't have to communicate much. Games that are esoteric or difficult to comprehend, or, you have to educate yourself on what the whole premise is, sometimes lose an audience. So I think one of the reasons why Borderlands is so successful and accessible is because it's really clear what's expected. Beyond that, though, we don't like to glorify violence just for the sake of it. So we created a universe where you're a good guy by doing these, like the things you're destroying need to go down. They need to be taken care of. Because we have like the fundamental game, it's basically a shooter and a role-playing game, right? And the role-playing game stuff is collecting loot and leveling up. Right, so to level up, you kill stuff and you get experience, and then you take the shit from the people you kill. So mm-hmm. Kill things and take their shit. So we had to invent a universe where if you kill things and take their stuff, you're a good guy. And that was like that was a challenge. But yeah, that's if you play it, like, that's why she's able to defend that, because she plays it and go, look, this is actually not violent in the context that you're worried about. If you actually understand it, it's got a lot of good messages and good qualities. In fact, I will go so far as to say, if you play Borderlands and you understand the content and you consume its contexts, you will be a better, more moral person.
Hey. Well, and just know that I make the solemn promise to you that I am going to play it.
All right, cool.
And And I will, not that you give
you
a
and
shit.
6 million other people know.
not that you give a shit, but I will.
No, I think
I will.
It's awesome.
I will call you afterwards and say I have.
I'll tell you something. We get mail all the time from people, like couples that play husbands and wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, and there was one couple. There was one guy that, he met his girlfriend playing Borderlands, and they fell in love in the game, and they happened to live in the same city, and they got together, and they happened to hit it off, and they became a thing, and then he was going to propose to her, and we actually it was such a he his
hang on a second, that game came out 7 months ago. How many months ago?
No, this was Borderlands.
Oh,
1.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I was gonna say it's too soon for them to get married.
Borderlands 1 came out in 2009.
Don't worry, you don't have to get married yet, Matt.
Good. And Borderlands 2 came out in 2012 in September, and they had their 1 year anniversary at our launch party for Borderlands 2.
That's adorable.
And in fact, we made a little when he wanted to propose, he sent us this awesome letter, and it was. It really touched us, so I sent it around to the team. We're like, "Oh, this guy's too awesome!" So we actually made a little video of Claptrap, the character from the video game, proposing to his girlfriend, and he had everybody come over, and he said, "Hey, we're gonna play," you know, because they apparently did these co-op sessions where a bunch of friends would come over and they'd all play Borderlands together. So he sets up the Xbox, you know, hit start, and instead of the game starting, this thing comes up, and she's like, "What the fuck?" And like one of the friends, you can watch it on YouTube, one of the friends videotaping
it. Oh, no way!
And it was incredible. It was, you know, so like those stories are great. So like, you know,
I see that
maybe you can become closer with Chloe if you. You know,
I will. It is actually very important to her because, you know, for Chloe, you know, one of the ways that she established a relationship with her father was playing Zelda.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
So she.
So you can totally exploit like the daddy issues thing by playing video games.
Well, I don't have to play video games to do that. shut up, John. but just the idea of using it as a connection tool, and I think, and I see this behavior more with game designers of like you said of, you know, when one of your fans reaches out to you, you know, you guys tend to be more than in other media that I see. Really interactive because you're in your demographic. And
yeah, that,
so you
that's
see
part of it.
You see yourself in that guy. You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I were a fan of a game and someone did this to me, I would shit my pants. And so I feel like you guys more than any other medium really are interactive in that way.
Well, and we have that opportunity too because of the nature of how we build games and how we, you know, it's you know, like I know you do a lot of the movie stuff, but usually there's no interaction between the filmmakers and, you know, the audience about the content until after the thing's in the can, right? So like there's no real opportunity to, unless you thought of what might, you know, and anticipated it in the script process or in the, you know, when you're just shooting it or whatever, you're just stuck with what you got. Whereas, you know, we show things way in advance and people are telling us what they think. And then, you know, when we're making sequels and we're making DLC and changing, like once we launch, it's not done. Like the game keeps changing. We'll keep modifying it, patching it, updating it and adding things.
Do you love DLCs? Like, do you love that that's an option?
I'll tell you, yes, that it's an option is great. And for some games, you know, sometimes there's some kinds of games we'll make and, you know, we're getting away from this, but you know, back in the day, we'd finish and just we're sick of it and we don't ever want to see it again. But like when we finished Borderlands 1, we felt like we just were barely getting started. Like none of us wanted to actually let it go. And so we just, you know, we shipped the game and then we're like, let's just keep working. And we didn't even have a DLC plan. We just were making more shit because we were so fun. And we're like, hey, there's some value here. Let's start figuring out how to put this together and maybe offer it to people. And it worked. And then we just went nuts with the first game and had just tons of DLC. And going into the second game, it allowed us to actually anticipate that and plan for it more and invest in it more. So
did you have any concept like, oh, Borderlands 1 is going to sell like 4 million copies? Like, did you have any concept when you made it? Did you even care if people bought it? Or were you like,
well,
you know what? We were proud of what we made and it doesn't, you know, like it'd be great if people bought it. But
a little bit of both. I mean, you know, as an entertainer, you know, the dream is, you know, the metrics are like, how many people can we reach and to what extent can we gratify them, right? It's like the idea is like we exist to make people happy and create joy. So part of that metric is how many people can we get to? And obviously we had a lot of confidence and belief in our bet there. That's why we, you know, had so much passion in creating it. But certainly the budget we had didn't anticipate the result. Like we, you know, what we needed to do was much less than what actually ended up happening, which was amazing, right? Like when you can have results that are, you know, three or four times what you hoped for, you're doing really good.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But then is there an immediate pressure like, oh shit, Now well, everything that comes after, it's got to be really, really good.
Yeah, no, that always exists, and it doesn't matter what you do. The expectations are always so high, and it's always an impossible job to live up to them. But, like, we live in that space. You know, we did all of the expansions for Half-Life.
Right.
Gearbox's first... Our first game was Half-Life Opposing Force, right?
Yeah.
So, like, here comes Half-Life, and it's like, oh, this upstart is going to really... You're going to follow Half-Life. Good luck with that. Like, everybody thought, oh, those guys are dead, you know, and we... Okay, so it's risky and it's, you know, big shoes to fill, but we dove in and we were just so passionate about the content. We love the universe those guys created, and, you know, a lot of our friends were up there working on that stuff, and we really wanted to do a good job. And it turned out we happened to make something in that case that everybody really liked, so it was a great start, you know. But, you know, sometimes, like, you know, we put a stupid amount of energy and money and time into our Aliens game, but it didn't work out as well. A lot of people didn't appreciate that as much as some of the other things we've done, you know. So it's tough as an entertainer, you know. Like, I think about some of the, you know, movie guys, and that, like, sometimes, you know, like Spielberg and Lucas get together and they create, like, Indiana Jones, and then other times they get together and they create Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, and then, like, you're like, what happened, you know? And then, like, oh, and then, you know, Spielberg makes Lincoln, and you're like, oh, you're good, it's cool, like, you know, you have skill,
your turn, George.
Yeah,
well, it's just
he might be done now. What's he gonna do next?
I don't know. Just be an awesome billionaire that gives away a bunch of money.
Yeah.
I always thought it'd be cool if he just tried to make, like, a small little personal movie about a family.
He did. It was called Red Tails.
I want a movie about a duck.
The movie about the Black Squadron of Fighters.
Oh,
that was
his
movie. That was his passion project, was to make that movie.
He's talking about, like
a little... But I'm saying, with George Lucas, that's as small as you'll get.
Jonah's saying he wants him to make, like, a Juno.
Yes.
I don't care. Not like an indie, like a, like, quirky movie, but, like, just like this really nice movie about right. It'd be neat to see what he would do with it. You know?
I don't care how big or small. Like, I want him to make more content, right? Because somewhere in there is the guy that came up with Star Wars.
Yeah.
Right? So that guy is still in there somewhere, and there was a moment when he was dreaming and passionate and found a way to articulate that into entertainment. And, like, I don't know where he is today, but it feels like that there's, like, I know that guy's in there somewhere. He's, like, under the, you know, Darth Vader mask, and we just need to crack
somewhere
it up
within
and
the jowls.
Yeah,
there still lies,
you know,
there. Yeah.
We need the blue version of, you know, the blue version of
yeah
of Lucas to make stuff for us.
How is your team in terms of I mean, you guys obviously all have to be accountable to one another, and is that where your quality control lies? Because, you know, if you start, you get a lot of success, and then, you know, pretty soon, I think for some people, they're in this kind of this stratum where they kind of don't know, because they're not really connected you know.
I'll tell you that it's less about, like, holding each other accountable, and it's, you know, most of the people that I work, like, I feel like I suck. Like, I suck all the time, and I'm just trying to get better and learn shit and try to suck a little less the next time. And I think most of the people that thrive at the studio generally have that kind of attitude. And, like, there's this, like, fundamental problem that all artists have, right? Which is your mind, when we start to imagine something, it's fucking amazing and perfect in our head, right? Like, and we can think so quickly and we get ideas so fast and they're perfect in our mind, and it takes so much time to realize that into something tangible, and when we do, it always falls way, way short, and we feel that, right? So everybody is just super harsh on themselves, and we only see the flaws, and we, you know, but we also we've had to figure out how to just not let that kill us, because you can work on something forever. You know, if you don't, especially anything artistic, you could just never be done. You could just keep tweaking it, and you'll never reach the thing that's in your head, because the thing in your head is perfect. And anything that's actually in the real world,
like,
is,
Chinese democracy.
Everything in the real world is short of perfect, like Chinese democracy. You know, so you just got to let it go and hope for the best. And you know, take your licks if you didn't get there, and apply your lessons to the next one. But yeah, that self-hate, like, it's like the artist dilemma. We just have to.
Well, it's hard because you can't just imprint what's in your brain onto a sheet of paper.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
As easy,
it
would be so much easier.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times your dexterity gets in the way.
Yeah.
If your dexterity count is low.
How long does it take you guys from, like, first of all, who says, okay, here's my idea for this video game at the company, and then who says, yes, let's make this one, hold off on that one? Like, so who does that?
So ultimately, like, I don't, like, okay, so we've got, like, 200 people, and there's,
right.
I have the good fortune of working with you know, amazing people, people that are way better than me that run circles around me. But
there's got to be like 12 guys that you don't like working
with. Out of 200. I mean, those are just
pretty good
odds.
It doesn't, no, I don't.
I work with two guys I hate.
Where?
What? John, where?
What?
Like in your other job
as a stand-up?
I'll tell you, you know, of the people at this table, two of you are okay.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Wait, he didn't say the third was great. The third could be a complete piece of shit.
That's true.
No, but, you know, in spite of all that, like, ultimately, usually I'm the guy. Like, like all of the concepts, like... And I don't know how to – I don't mean to be condescending with that. And like I
– No, just that's the question. So it's
most
you.
Of the stuff – but most of the stuff that I choose to get behind, most of it, Brian, who's one of the owner – one of the – you know, one of my partners, one of the owners of the studio, one of the founders with me, like he's like this crazy visionary. And so he'll be planting most of the seeds.
Yeah.
And then I'll – like some of the seeds I'll be able to feel like – okay, if I turn that into this, and then like there's a market for that, yeah. and then I'll try to rally consensus around that belief, and then effort starts to happen, and we start to
okay.
Run
sub question yeah. From this, from when you say yes, let's go ahead with this, from that day to release day, how long of a period of time is that?
Depends, man. Like Half-Life Opposing Force, we sat around in my living room talking about the concept of, hey, what if we played from the opposite side? Like, we're the soldiers instead of, you know, the scientists. And that was just one afternoon. And then, like, a week later, I flew up to Seattle and pitched Gabe. And then we had that thing on store shelves 8 months after that.
Wow.
So, like, that's one end of the spectrum.
Mm.
And then the other end of the spectrum is, like, there's things that we have been tinkering with that have been, you know, kicked around and have been played with that could be, you know, considered projects that have been going on at Gearbox since 1999, right? Nothing's been announced, and we'll
don't Duke Nukem me, man. Don't Duke Nukem me, man.
See, that's where it becomes a problem. Once you feel like, oh, I think we've got enough, let's announce it. Like, don't ever, like, that's the new rule is we're not saying shit until we're like basically alpha with our
right.
Game.
Like, you know, it's like people won't tell you they're pregnant until after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they want to make sure like everything's okay.
You've got to stop watching. I didn't know I was pregnant.
I can't help it.
Those are rare cases.
How can they not know? How can they think it's that they have to take a shit?
Well, you know,
it's
happened on
expectations Mad Men. Are, you know, they're tough, man. It's like once you've made a problem, like with the, like for example with the aliens thing, when the deal was done, the ink was not even dry. We hadn't even written the first line of code yet, and Sega and Fox were so excited that the business deal was done, they made a press release. So we hadn't even started working on it, and now the customer can immediately imagine, wow, you know, Gearbox is using the Gears of War engine to make
and then the clock
game.
Starts ticking in their brains.
And that, yes, and they've got, and like I was talking about earlier, right, the vision's instant, and it's perfect, and it's amazing, and it's the vision you have for that. It's impossible to ever
and
it's there.
You know what happens?
And everybody
I'm going to be a space marine. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
But when the clock starts ticking, then it's, you know, then you have things like E3 where people go, I didn't hear anything about that thing. They totally dropped the ball. Then
that's
people
right.
just start writing their own story.
Exactly.
And you're like, God damn it. Just give it. Oh, fuck. You know,
the E3 display last year was very good. They had the original Alien maquette.
Yeah,
it
was pretty awesome.
It was pretty sweet.
But I'm not going to announce a damn thing until we're pretty far along.
What's one project that you were like super excited about and then you started doing it and you're like, ah, we can't do this. This isn't going to work.
Let's see. We haven't had... I mean, there's been a lot of things that we've tinkered around with in a concept phase, but there's really not been a lot of things where we've really invested in building that we haven't figured out some path through there. But actually, Borderlands is a good example of that. We knew from the beginning, I knew from the beginning, that that blending the RPG elements that we wanted to bring into the FPS space was a good mix, that no one had done that before, and that the things I love about looting, like when I play like a game like that, have you played Diablo?
Yeah.
Okay, so like Diablo, right? You like
I always play as a sorceress.
Yeah, you click the mouse and you kill shit and loot comes out and you collect the loot and you get experience and you level up and it's just this awesome loop, right? And if you think about the actual skill test, like you're pointing a cursor at an icon and you're clicking, like the skill,
then you're out of it.
The actual skill to play the game, it's the same skill that's required to launch the application, right? It's like I could play the only difference between desktop and Diablo is the whole loot and leveling.
I'm double clicking
in the
to
context.
Open the application.
But you're
if you're on a PC.
But like your melee is automated.
Yeah, like a lot of things are just sort of and it's actually because it's so accessible that it's good for so many users. So I don't want to criticize the game loop. It's an amazing game loop. But what makes it compelling is the fact that I'm getting loot. I'm making choices about gear. I'm growing my character. I'm exploring. I'm discovering things, and I'm leveling up, and I'm becoming more powerful. All of those things. There's nothing about any of those things that are mutually exclusive with the loop of a shooter. Now, the shooter is typically on the exact opposite end of the spectrum. There is most shooters you play. There's no difference between the character at the end of the game and the character at the beginning of the game.
Right.
There's no growth. There's no choice. Like it's really mostly the compulsion is it's a fun loop. Like it just feels good to move and aim, and the feedback when you pull the trigger and it makes an awesome sound, and you see the feedback of the enemy getting hit, and it's just fun in like the moment to moment. But it kind of sucks in the long thing. You know, sometimes we make these really shitty narratives that are supposed to be the thing that makes you want to see the next level. But, you know, let's face it, most FPS games have terrible, you know, storytelling, and that isn't enough. And so it's really the moment to moment fun, and the moment to moment fun of a shooter, there's nothing about that that's mutually exclusive with the like longer range engagement that comes from looting and leveling and growth and choice and discovery that you find in a looter, you know, like an RPG game. And so I knew that bet was correct. I knew that was going to work. We just had to figure out how to tweak and tune and balance and design it. The thing that we completely fucked up on and had no, like we were just totally off base when we started the game, the art direction was realism. Like, if you go back and you can actually see demos of Borderlands when it was like, it looked like fucking Call of Duty. Like, it was trying to be super realistic, and it didn't fit at all with the tone or the like what we were going for. And we went like most of the development down that road, and I was like, this is not going to work. It was actually my partner Brian that I was talking about earlier said, you know, he decided he was going to solve that problem. And he went in the tank and he took a few guys off to the side. And they invented this whole new art style, and they had some inspiration. There's this really awesome short that was done like some guys out of Asia that it was called Code Hunters that has like some you can feel some of the art, and we put a like direct homage Easter egg right at the beginning of the game to you know pay homage to those guys. We put Easter eggs all over our games. We love that stuff. But what he did was he just turned it on its head and just basically threw away all of the realism shit and created this you know graphic novel come to life. Kind of look, and once that happened, like we all were cut loose, and the game really became great. And I don't know, the game might have sucked if we didn't make that call, if we didn't trash our original art design and go with this new one.
And so was that was sort of the genesis of that game was we want to combine these two different styles of game, to create. So are there any games that you develop that it's just like story first? I really want to tell this particular story, and then you sort of figure out like what's appropriate.
Yeah, in fact, you know, to let you in behind the curtain a little bit, you can imagine a game promise by breaking it into these three ideas. One is story, another style, and the third is design. Story isn't like the plot; it's like the premise, like who, what, why, where, when. Like, are you a space marine saving the world from aliens? Are you a wizard slaying dragons? Are you yourself solving puzzles, like whatever. There's some narrative there that's just the general premise behind it. That's story. Style is look and feel. It's art direction. It's audio direction. And design is like the controls, like what buttons do I press and what genre is it in as far as a gameplay loop goes. Where's the camera? You know, camera and control are a lot of what the design is. And the three things together kind of, if they all work in concert, those are the best games where everything kind of feeds into itself. But almost every single time a game is first conceived of, it starts with one of those three points. Sometimes it starts on story, like I'd like to make a wizard game or something, right? Or sometimes it's on design, like wouldn't it be neat if, like in the case of Borderlands, if we blended RPG and shooter, right? That was started as a design. Some of it's style. Brothers in Arms started on style, like we did, like desaturated. You know, gritty, you know, using kind of juxtaposing modern technology with, you know, stock footage from the 1940s, right? And it started on a style point of view. And then from there we thought, okay, it's probably a war game. Right. And then like, okay, what war? Like we were all over the fucking place. We were thinking Civil War. Like we didn't start with the story of World War II. We actually arrived there after we did some research and learned something about war. And then game design was last. Like, okay, now that we know something about this war, wow, it turns out that these dudes fought not like what we're used to in video games, where it's just like, you know, but they actually, there's fire and maneuver, and there's, you know, flanking and suppressing, and there's all these tactics involved in close combat. And the other thing that was interesting that we learned when we were exploring the story aspects was that the guy, like, we talked to a lot of veterans, and almost every time when, like, we'd ask the tough questions, like, okay, dude, how do you fucking shoot another human being? Or how do you get your head up and expose yourself so that someone, you know, someone's going to blow your head off so that you can aim your gun and actually try to kill someone else? Like, how do you fucking do that? What is it, you know? And what we learned over and over is it was never about, like, duty, honor, country. It was never about, like, oh, it's, you know, democracy, or, you know, in the moment, it was like, I don't want the guy next to me to think I'm a coward, or I don't want to let down the guy next to me, because it's always, and that's where the whole brothers in arms concept came from. We learned it's all about the brotherhood between soldiers, and the fact that you just, when there's a guy that's counting on you and you're counting on him, like, nobody wants to be the shithead there. So they just put themselves in these extreme situations and do the hard job. And so that's an example where style came first, that led to story, and that, and the story things we learned led to the design of the tactical gameplay and, you know, squad combat and, like, you know, working with teammates and stuff. And
well, it's hard to have that. I mean, just to have that kind of holistic idea, you know, because obviously some people are better at one thing.
Yeah.
But then, oh, the game looked like shit. Oh, that's a cool idea, but that, then it's, oh, and that didn't really.
I think that's one of the superpowers of Gearbox, and it's probably, if I had, like, there's a lot of things that there's people at my studio that run circles around me, and I'm like a okay to shitty programmer today, and I think I'm a pretty good designer, but we've got some amazing people that are just unbelievable at that stuff. But probably my superpower is thinking about the nexus of how those fit together. And, you know, Borderlands was an interesting case study because we started with the design pitch, and I knew for certain if somebody cracks this nut, holy shit, it's, like, gonna work, because it's so, like, RPG loops are so addicting and so engaging in spite of the worst, you know, game loops or simplest mechanics possible. Meanwhile, shooters done well are just fun just in the moment. So I knew that was gonna work. We kind of invented a story, you know, the premise, the setup that allowed for these things. Like I said earlier, like, we had to come up with a universe where you're a good guy if you kill people and steal their shit, right? Like, so that was the so story followed design, and then style was like, we fucked it up. Not only did it come last, but we missed. Like, we started with this realism thing, and it took one of our artists to fix it.
At least you figured it out.
Yeah.
When you said, hey, everybody, we're changing the way this looks, did everybody put their heads against the wall and just go, oh?
No, it was the opposite of that, because I think for a long time most of us felt there was a little disconnect there. We trust the game design loop was so good that I think it'll worked out either way. And I think we were afraid actually of going non-realism, because we know there's fundamentally kind of a ceiling with that. Like, in if you're trying to think about, like, I want to create a mega property in video games, right, there's a ceiling to non-realistic art direction. Like, you just can't, like, there's no example you could find of someone doing better than, say, 10 million units of a you know, traditional box product, you know, console game with a non-realistic art style. In fact, I think the bar before Borderlands exists was like 5 million units. I think Borderlands has created a new ceiling. But so that was really scary, right? So I think there was, like, this weird tension, like, well, the style isn't right, but fuck, we don't want to bring our ceiling down, you know. But it was actually Brian that tore it off. And what he did was how I found out about it, like, somebody came up to me one day, is like, dude, hey, Randy, have you seen what Carl's been doing? Carl's one of our environment artists. He's like a brilliant visual guy that can, like, build a scene and make it look amazing. And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, isn't Carl doing what he's supposed to be doing? Like, and they're like,
come
oh,
quick, Carl's doing crack.
And they're like, oh, never mind, you might want to talk to Brian. So I went to Brian. I'm like, what's going on, dude? And he's like, okay, so anyway, you know that problem we've been having with style? So I think I've got an idea, but I need to kind of prove it. I can't explain it. I see it in my head, and I need some guys that I can kind of work through it with. And I'm kind of just doing that. He's just kind of like, he just commandeered a few people and just did it, like, as a Skunk Works kind of underground operation. I'm like, okay, first of all, you're awesome for trying to solve that problem. Secondly, like, no wonder all the producers hate you, because you randomize process and just take time. But it's like, okay. Sure. So we made a deal. He had like 5 guys, and he had 3 weeks, and he was going to make a demo. And that was the deal that we made. And then in 3 weeks, I was going to look at this demo, and I was going to make a call. Like, we were going to, it was going to show us something, or sorry, thanks for wasting our time. So, and I remember, like, the third week, they set up the demo, and Brian left town. Like, he and his wife, they had, like, oh, we got some family thing in, you know, Minnesota, and, like, he was gone.
And his feet, like, he was like Fred Flintstone, his feet moved before he actually left.
I make fun of it, but I think it was honest. I think he actually had that trip planned well in advance of the demo. But anyway, he wasn't there that day. I always like to make fun that he just was afraid to be there. And the other guys were so nervous. And I remember going into the room, and there was just the five guys that were just the Skunk Works guys, and they were the only guys that knew what they had, and they had this little demo that they built. And I remember walking into it thinking, like, I have no idea what the fuck they've been doing, but no matter what it is, like, we are just a couple of months from alpha. It doesn't matter what it is, because I know it's big and going to be disruptive, and that means I have to shoot it in the head. And now I'm thinking, like, fuck, why did I even let them go 3 weeks? Because now they're going to be all attached to it, and it's going to hurt their feelings. Somebody's going to quit when I shoot it in the head, because there's no way I can let this thing happen. It'd just break all the plans, and it would be...
After you shoot it in the head, loot it.
It would be completely irresponsible for me to let whatever this is be anything more. And I was before I even saw what they had to show me, I was regretting even giving them the 3 weeks. I should have just stopped it before it started, is what I was thinking. But, you know, something about... what actually led to me letting it happen was better instinct, because once it showed up and I saw, like, it was a pretty awesome representation of what you see in the final game. I was like, holy fuck, this is like, I am inside of a graphic novel. And yeah. I've never felt that before. Like, I've never seen that in a video game before. And it was astonishing. And it was like, okay, I want this. Like, this is so obviously the right thing. And then we, because we knew we wanted it, so and then we kind of let the studio all start to talk about it, because we had to go through the process. Can we do it or not?
Yeah.
What will it cost for us to do it this way instead of what we're doing? Like, because we basically are, restarting the art direction. How can we afford to even make this move? And so we had to kind of widen it up, open the kimono, let everybody kind of understand, and go through the process of figuring out if we can do it. By the time we were done with that, the studio feeling was, oh, we have to do this. So it wasn't like a... oh fuck surprise. It was like, this dude's like, we have got to find a way. This is the most amazing thing ever. And everybody was so fired up. But I had the problem, like, you know, we're an independent developer, it's our brand and all that, but, you know, we have a publishing partner that has a lot at stake and a lot invested. So I'm like, fuck, I gotta tell the 2K Games guys, I gotta tell Take-Two and those guys that we're doing this. They might not agree with us. So I took a demo and I had a video made. I think we accidentally left the video on like the PC disc, so somebody ripped it and put it on YouTube. So if you want to watch it, it's cool. It's like the prototype video.
Oh, no. Oh,
wow. And it's if you YouTube Greenfields Borderlands, because there was this old song that my dad had, this album from like the 1940s or something. It was the Brothers Four. This is an old band, and they had the song called Greenfields, and it was like this a cappella, you know. It's like, green fields are gone now, parched by the sun, you know, and it's like all this really
fucking cool
mood. Cool
and melancholy.
Yeah, so like, and it's like 1940s, so it's all scratchy record. Yeah. And so I took the song and I kind of recut it a little bit, because I didn't like, the chorus was good, but like they did this weird kind of bit in like the third measure that didn't work. So I actually removed that and remade the song. If you listen to the original,
fuck that, dead musicians.
I'm a dick that way, but I improved it, I think. But you know, it's up to you to decide. But anyway, and I took that song and the couple guys from the cinematics team took some shots from the demo and put them together and made this little scene. And that's what I brought to 2K. And I'd show up to, you know, in Nevada, California, to their offices, and I had my USB key with this on there, and I'm like, all right guys, this is gonna be a shock, but anyway, you know. So, and I took the head creative guy and I showed him the video first. I just let him see the video, and then it did the same thing to his mind that it did to mine, because I knew that the creative people and the marketing people were probably going to be easy, and it was just the production people that are going to shit their fucking pants. Right? So I kind of like subjugated and went in there and kind of planted seeds with all of the more creative types and the marketing types before I, you know, put it in front of the PD guys. And then we had everybody together in one of their conference rooms, and we ran the live demo and, you know, and showed them. And what's cool is, before we showed up, we had already done the math on what it was going to take. So we already figured out all the production process. So when all the PD people were like, what the fuck? Like, we're like, oh, dude, look, check it out. We can do this.
Oh, nice.
And it was, and everybody thumbs up it. And that was one of those great rare examples of the publisher being on the team of the talent
and
supporting the talent.
Did that push the release date at all, or did you guys just double time?
We hadn't announced a release date yet.
Oh, great.
So we did.
See, that's going back to being smart.
That's right.
Grand Theft Auto 5. Where the fuck are you?
we had a little flexibility there, so it actually and as we started to look at what window we should be targeting, there wasn't a lot of great options, and so we found a spot that we were able to hit, and that spot was in October of 2009. And it was kind of – there was a couple of things that were big that were coming out in September, like, Halo. And there were – you know, and then there was a couple of things that come out big that are in November, like, Call of Duty. Right? So, like, we have this tiny little window squeaking in between a Halo and a Call of Duty game. We're going to have our little humble little shooter show up with our tiny little marketing budget and our little development budget. And that's – that's our only spot. And it turned out that we were able to make that with the plan we had. So we nailed it.
When you're looking at release dates, how far do you want to go between these giant – like release dates, like is it because I know with movies it's the kind of thing where Iron Man will come out and then we can do it, we can go next week
if you movies are a little different, but if you could wave a magic wand, the best solution would be if those other games just didn't even exist.
Create
a vacuum, and it's not what it really is. It's not necessarily that you can't find a customer, because you know the reality of entertainment is there's not a portion of the reality is there's not competition, right? Like sometimes there are 6 months where there's not a damn thing in the movie theater that you want to go see. Then, like, you remember that year when a Harry Potter movie came out like the same week as Lord of the Rings, and guess what? We see them both. And the entertainment industry tends to expand and contract based on the quality of the promises. So, like, the more awesome stuff that's out there, the more we're going to dive into it and want to consume it. And, you know, some people with limited budgets, they can't consume it all right away, but they're going to get around to it, and that revenue.
But there's also predicted with movies, or at least, you know, I mean, when you're talking about Borderlands via Borderlands versus Halo or Call of Duty, you're talking about like really effective counter programming in a way.
Yeah, well, that
where you go, this actually is interesting to release it at this time because it's totally different than the other two things that are around it.
That's a rationalization, because the flip side of the entertainment expands and contracts based on the quality of the promise. The flip side is there's a real limit. There's a limited, you know, there's some limitations and resources. For example, if you want to have posters on the windows of GameStop, there's only, you know, one set of windows in a GameStop. And so whoever's got their poster up, that's it. They're the ones that are going to get the imprint. So, like, if you happen to be trying to sell your game when Call of Duty has their poster up, sorry, Call of Duty's getting their poster up, you know, and they win. Halo's going to get their poster up. There's a reason why Halo is in September and Call of Duty is in November. Like, the reason why that gap is there so both of them get to have their fucking posters up.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, we didn't get posters. Like, we didn't. So, like, that whole opportunity was missed for us. Now, in Borderlands 2, we got all the fucking posters we wanted. You know, Borderlands 1 was, like, a miracle to those guys. Like, we moved the needle for every business, you know, for retail, for the public. Publishers, for everything, for the first parties, Sony and Microsoft, like, we move the needle for everybody.
So, but in a publisher's book of like, this is how we can make the most money and this is how we can reach the most people, is there like a window of like, well, okay, if there's a big release, we have to do it, at least 3 weeks out after them.
There's some science to it. Yeah. There's also some art and some tradecraft to it as well. So, but yeah, there's some science. I mean, and some of it has to do with exactly what I was saying, or ad buys, right? Like, you know, there's only so many spots on television that you can get for video game content, right? And if some other games bought up all the spots with the right demographic, then it doesn't matter how much money you've got. You can't – the spots are claimed, right? So, you know, timing is a big part of it. Yeah.
When you're looking at different platforms, how much does that inform how you design a game, where you go, well, if we're going to have it on – you know, if we're going to have it on this platform, if we're going to have it on PC, or if we're going to have it on console, or, you know, if we, God forbid, there's some sort of a mobile element to this game, how does that inform how you design the game? Because each platform is going to dictate how you interact with the game, and that obviously says a lot about... I mean, you know, it's like, Diablo, it's like, well, you know, it was a point and click because there's just not a lot of action
Diablo,
when you're doing this.
I'm really curious. I can't wait to try Diablo 3 on the PlayStation 4 because I don't, like, to me, how do you do it? Like, to me, it's like, I need a mouse.
Yeah.
You
know, what if it's still just a point and click?
Oh, my God. See, that would suck, right? So I don't think Blizzard's...
No, they won't do that.
Blizzard's really good, so they're probably not going to do that because that would suck. That. So they probably thought of something. And I'm fascinated. They're probably doing some new UI for how you trigger your abilities instead of clicking the numbers on the keyboard or clicking the icons on the screen. They're probably doing something else or using the buttons or the D-pad in some interesting selection kind of way. I don't know, but we'll all get to experience that, and it'll be a great lesson for all of us, you know, humble designers that only aspire to be as good as Blizzard. But yeah, it's multi-platform games. Like on one level, if you remember the dream, like, I'm an entertainer. How many people can I reach, and to what extent can I gratify them? So when you think about that first metric, how many people can I reach? The more platforms, the better, right? There are some people that own PlayStation that don't own Xbox. Sure. There are some people that own PC that don't own either console, and so on. In fact, the crossover is surprisingly low. You'd be in the real world; it's an astonishingly low number of.
I
have everything, so I'm like, oh, you know, it's easy. Yeah. And a lot of us that make things kind of trick ourselves, and you know, get confirmation bias because we have that experience. We think everyone has that experience,
right.
But in fact, no. There's extremely low crossover.
Yeah, because it takes a lot of energy to port your brain over to a bunch of different platforms, and you just get really comfortable with one.
That's
with one choice. Where
that's
like,
one part of it, and another part of it, they're not free. Right?
They're not
so,
free.
So
yeah.
You know, it turns out that, you know, there's a whole lot of people, even in you know, we're in America, the wealthiest country in the world, and it turns out most people don't have all the fucking money. It's actually pretty fucked up the way the balance
is. So you can't buy the Xbox with the biggest hard drive and a PS3 or a PS4 soon, and also like a crazy Alienware, like a Falcon Northwest customized gaming laptop.
So that part makes us wish to be on as many platforms as possible if we want to entertain all those people, but then it also creates these problems because there's differences with the platforms. Fortunately, the controllers between what Sony tends to do and what Microsoft tends to do are pretty close. They have the same number of inputs mostly.
Yeah.
Like, there's subtleties to them, and we have to account for those subtleties. You know, the triggers are really nice to fire the gun with on the Xbox, where it's actually kind of better to fire use the shoulder button as a trigger on the PlayStation controller. It just feels better that way. So, and then that causes us to invest in things like, hey, now there's a place you can go in the options menu where you can configure it however you want. You can assign the buttons however you want to so that you can customize the controls for yourself. Oh, and we've also preset it. So if you've already played, for example, Call of Duty, we have like a set called Tour of Duty, and it's like basically the same interface. Or like if you played Halo, we have like Ring World, and you can like, if I pick Ring World, that means this is going to be the grenade button because that's what it is in Halo, and you know, it just tends to, and we kind of think that we solve those problems ahead of time. So, but it is difficult, and one of the things that really sucks is there's performance differences. Like in this generation, the Xbox is generally a little more powerful than the PlayStation 3. There's some couple of subtle advantages it has. So it tends to be so the lowest common denominator is the PlayStation 3. And meanwhile, like the high end of the PC is just extreme. And you know, so like for example, when you watch a trailer or see demos for upcoming video games that are multi-platform, you're almost always seeing content that's PC content.
Yeah.
And it's always, frankly, it's a little bit dishonest, right? Because if you're a console customer, what you're going to actually see, like when you play the big games on the console and you've seen this beautiful high definition, every texture is high fidelity, you know, in the demo or the trailer or whatever you saw. And then when you play it on the Xbox or the PlayStation 3, the textures are muddier. You know, they're lower fidelity materials on the surfaces. Sometimes there's lower resolution models and assets in the game just because the processors aren't as powerful as the high-end PCs. You know, this is a real challenge. And like, so what do? You have two options. One is just, you know, leverage the fact that the PC is most powerful and the people that get to play that have that amazing experience, and you get to use that experience as your marketing front face, right? Or the other choice you can make is, well, nerf the PC. You know, let's go for platform parity. So everyone's seeing the same content. You know, and you know, we've done it all different ways, and there's no winner. Like each way we've tried it, some, you know, there's angst from one
platform.
There's
a segment that complains.
There's a segment There's a segment that complains, and you know, but
always a segment that complains.
You know, so, but it sucks if you're an entertainer because you really just exist to try to make people happy.
Yes, I know
If you exist to try to make people happy and you never can, it's like this endless, like, oh god.
Well, first of all, I've never.
We just cry ourselves asleep.
I love that idea that you keep saying, because I've never heard, and maybe they all think this, but just I've never heard another. I've never heard another game designer refer to themselves as an entertainer, you know, which is a much more is a little bit more of an artistic way of referring to that, and it because it really, that's really what it is.
It is, it is, and well, that's what I figured out is why I exist. You know, it's why I used to, you know, why I did theater in school, and why I, you know, did comedy, and why I did magic. You know, I just, for some reason, I am only happy if I feel like I'm affecting other people in a way that makes their life more interesting or better, or kind of makes them laugh or feel good or something, or just feel anything. Like, it's, unless I'm affecting someone else, I'm not doing anything worthwhile. And some of us just happen to be built that way. There's a lot of cool things we can do, right? There's a lot of ways that a life can be spent in a worthwhile way that helps our species, right? Like, some people figure out how to become doctors and help us live longer lives, or some people, you know, become police officers or join the military and help us live safer and more secure lives, or some people become civil engineers and help our roads or bridges be better and faster so that we can have more efficient lives. But what I figured out at some point was all of that is cool, but if I remove joy and happiness from my experience, and if we remove joy and happiness from all experience, then life would be worthless. Like, it's only because of joy and happiness that life has any meaning at all. And it's when I realized that I kind of decided that the most noble people in the world are those that kind of create happiness and joy for the rest of us.
There's no question that we do the most important work.
Absolutely.
Oh, no question whatsoever.
No, seriously. Imagine the universe. Imagine the world where no one experienced any joy and happiness. Like that, like why?
Is that Matt Myra's world?
What?
I don't think it's hard to imagine.
Fuck you and
hey,
fuck you.
See, that's a good idea.
Thank you for joining
us. He's doing it, Jonah. Hey, is it?
We'd all be Al-Qaeda or something. You know?
Hey, by the way, did Valve drop their little hardware game controller thing that they were doing?
What about it?
Did they stop doing it? Did they abandon it?
Well, what's funny is that's one of those great examples. Like, what's the actual narrative there? Valve never really announced anything. There was clearly some hardware company that they had some kind of interaction with.
Yeah.
And that hardware company, they already made devices that fit in a box that were pretty neat and compact. And that hardware company, I think, kind of exploited that interaction to create this meme that, oh, there's a Steam Box. There's never been like the Steam Box product page. There's never been the Steam Box press release. There's never been any announcement from Valve. There had been plenty of times when Valve's been looking at hardware, right? We're hiring hardware specialists, and who knows what the fuck they're making? They could be making glasses that have, you know, Google glasses for all we know.
They could be trying to take down Dyson with a cool vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, exactly. But we, like, there was the, you know, one of the guys did a white paper about that kind of other kind of stuff. So, but I think what happened was the community kind of put all this together and just made an expectation that there was never actually a promise about. I think that it's, you know, if I had a platform like Steam, and my platform, because of the way it works, I'm dependent upon the PC and I'm dependent upon Windows. And I know Microsoft's a little strange and they're doing weird things with Windows. Like, what's Windows 8? What's the future of PC going to be? Are they going to be selling more PCs or less? Is Windows 8 going to be better or worse? And I'm dependent on, like, I don't, if they just suddenly evaporated, I cease to exist, right? So if I was living in that world, I would be thinking about hardware. I'd be thinking about, could I maneuver quickly enough where I could exist in the event that Microsoft suddenly evaporates? Like, so that's kind of a natural thing for them to explore. But I think the ecosystem's such where they don't need to race at that, right?
Right.
Windows is healthy. We're all able to play Steam. They're still growing the customer base on Steam. So there's no real reason for them to race at dropping their own hardware. They probably flirted with, like, hey, let's endorse something, or, you know, maybe we can put our brand on something because it's cool. But, I think the reality is there's just no actual.
You can play Steam on Mac. People like to do that,
and that's cool, and that's growing. I actually encourage more of that.
All
I think
13 of those games, I play them.
Like, I know how much Valve's made off of our games. I encourage them to invest as much of that as possible into making the platform bigger and better.
By the way, going back to something you said earlier, I really just had this this idea to create a GLaDOS vacuum cleaner.
Hell yeah, dude!
Which basically like a GLaDOS shaped vacuum cleaner that just sassed you the entire time.
You know, like on ThinkGeek.com, there's probably like 4 or 5 dozen customers.
I'm gonna talk to the ThinkGeek guys. Let's make the maybe I'll see if I can convince them that'd be the April Fool's joke next year, the GLaDOS vacuum cleaner. That would be fucking amazing.
That'd be awesome.
Not now that you said it.
Ah, shit.
Yes,
I ruined it.
It's ruined.
Do you need me to make an edit?
No!
Okay.
Boner
farts.
How much of game designing now is actual coding and programming versus like having some sort of a shell program or having some sort of an engine that you can plug things into,
or a shell company where you're moving money around?
that's more you know, point and click.
Well, about a third of the craftspeople, the tradesmen in our studio, are programmers. So if by that metric, you know, about a third of it's programming. But that being said, we build a huge amount of scaffolding, which are like tools, and the programming is actually creating access to what you're really doing. The programming is like one of the things that makes it possible, for example, to offer 87 bazillion guns. Like I don't know what the exact count is. It's actually in the Guinness Book of World Records. They have the exact count. Like, we have the world record for most guns in a video game. That's not the number of guns that we've created, the number of tools and pieces of equipment and gear. It's just not possible for human teams to craft that many. So we built software that actually procedurally generates it for us. And that's pretty neat, right? Like, the computer is making shit. Like,
right, self-aware. Great.
So yeah, when Skynet happens, they already have a program that can build guns.
We got it, yeah.
3D printers of guns.
Yeah, well, you plug the 3D printer into the Borderlands AI system, and boom, Skynet.
Skynet's not – I mean – I don't know if I ever believed the idea that Skynet would start as a defense system. Skynet would be a video game.
You are
absolutely.
You're a Skynet engineer, so let's hear it.
No doubt about it. Let's give Congress more ammunition to cause problems for our industry. Skynet starts as a video game, certainly.
Yeah, we need to put a little some more restrictions on video games.
Yes,
because
you know that's coming. And the guy that says it has that voice.
Where are you from? I'm from Nevada. I'm from Massachusetts.
Look at this. They're trying to put a net over our sky.
Are you going to let video games into
you can never drink a sweet tea on the porch because there's a net up on the sun.
Well, I think he's saying we should outlaw all video games.
Yes,
no,
exactly.
I'm saying outlaw the sun.
I'm really having difficulty telling which side
I'm
you're
not
on.
Not sure where I am.
I'm old and no one can fire me.
He's on the sides of the robots. Get him.
He is a robot.
Oh, these Jim Crow laws have to go.
Robot discrimination, that's the new problem. Damn, we just aren't letting robots and humans marry. It's
damn it.
That's going to be a social issue of the future, by the way.
I have a really old Santa pit that I was never able to make it work, but it was all about robot racism. It's like human beings are predisposed to basically sectioning off in groups and then pointing fingers at other groups. And when people will point to robots. I mean, it's
almost certain, right?
It's sort of the Asimov thing. Like, there's
when Asimov's rules go by the wayside. Then
it's sort of like that will be the next.
They are second class citizens
that they're trying to acclimate. You know,
well, it's almost inevitable that we will be able to create intelligence. We'll be able to create consciousness, and it's almost inevitable that some of the consciousness we're able to create synthetically will be more advanced than what our own brains are capable
and
of.
Some will be malicious,
and some might be malicious. That'll be something we're all going to
have
to do.
Do you guys have some sort of a bat cave where that shit's going on?
You know, I wish. I am resentfully jealous of the people that get to exist.
You know who's doing that?
100,000 years from now.
You know who's doing that?
They're going to have such awesome stuff.
I'll tell you who's doing it is Sergey. Sergey Brin is doing it.
Oh, yeah, probably.
There's, like, under the entire Google campus is the biggest real bat cave with insane,
I'm sure.
That's where the Metroid mother brain is.
Oh, right? My God. Oh,
it's
my!
It's sitting there right now. You thought that was fiction.
There's, there's.
Let's get our ice shot.
There's weird sort of like quadrupedal appliances that are pets.
And every time you Google something, you help it along.
Yes,
feed that brain. You feed that mother brain. But you know, I'll tell you.
Well, you should bing it, everybody.
Someday, I mean, it's also almost inevitable that like. All of the places we are not sufficiently progressive as a species, like, it's almost inevitable that we'll get all past that, right? Like, all the things that people think are big deals now, oh no, someday we'll all figure out that humans are cool and everybody's differences are cool, and then it's going to be robots. It's going to be like the non-humans, but some of the non-humans are going to be really useful and kind of symbiotic with our species, and some of the non-humans that we've probably created might be more effective than we are. And some of them might be – eventually we'll get the capacity to self-replicate. And, like, you know, hopefully it's all, you know, for good. And hopefully we all can deal with that as a species. But it'll be embarrassing if we start to reach those possibilities technologically before we figured out how to actually fucking get along as actual humans ourselves.
I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
And if we can't – progress enough, you know, with the humanity side of it before we get the technology where the synthetic stuff can beat us, then we might have Skynet type issues, yeah. Because the superior synthetic minds we might create will realize that we're just fucking stupid and might want to deal
with it.
For
our own good.
Or they'll keep us around so they can try to understand love.
And I just invented a new movie plot. So.
Shit, let's do it. Well, that's an interesting idea. Any plans to cross over? Do you feel like, you know, like, it was funny that when they announced that that J.J. Abrams and Gaben were talking about like developing stuff together, because
that was cute.
When I talked to him before, he was like, well, it's just the right, I don't know, it'd have to be the right thing, and that's never, and it's very, I feel like it's harder to create a movie from a video game, even more so than a book, because people form such intimate relationships with a video game, and a lot of a video game is a mirror for who their personality is. Then yeah. How do you represent that in one linear two-hour story?
So it's probably an obvious thing that a lot of folks from Hollywood have come at us trying to get, you know, options for our brands. Like Borderlands is a great one. And,
can I just have it?
And there's
I thought maybe that'd be the clever way to get it.
And Brothers in Arms. And in fact, we actually gave an option to some folks a while back for that. And then there was, you know, there's Duke Nukem, and there's been some interest here and there about that. And there's, you know, so that, you know, obviously we've kind of thought about that problem a lot. And like, on one hand, like, oh, it'd be awesome to have a movie, you know, but you know, we're doing all right. We don't need it. And
you don't want to risk fucking up your brand.
Like, I'm in no hurry to see a bad movie made. You know, that's right. Not going to help. And, like, here's a question. Name a good video game movie.
You can't. Because the best ones are the Resident Evil ones, and they're not that good.
They're not bad, but like, also, what do they have to do with the games, right?
Well,
like,
yes, yeah,
they actually like that. That's a problem, right?
That's just brand. That's just branding. I guess. They rather recognize that name, and but I think we'll all agree that Super Mario Brothers 1991.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing.
It's funny that it worked.
If we can reach that standard,
it kind of
works. Bob Hoskins. That's John Leguizamo.
That's a good cast.
It works both ways, though, if you think about it, because there's never been a really great video game based on a movie.
What about like GoldenEye?
I beg to differ. Batman: Arkham Asylum.
Not based on a movie. That's based on the comics.
Well, fair enough. Fair enough.
But what was the one you just said?
You might have had the right answer there.
Yeah, GoldenEye.
GoldenEye was amazing. Yeah.
E.T.
Okay.
Chippendale's Rescue Rangers was a great video game.
They buried all DuckTales the E.T. games. Really,
I liked Aladdin.
Yeah,
Aladdin was good, too. So.
Come on, guys. Battletoads movie.
Turns out I was wrong.
Yeah. You could probably come up with a few. Really worked at it. Read the comments later. Yeah. Your audience will help you.
I played Battletoads.
It's not helping. It's hurting.
I played Battletoads recently.
Shut down.
At a cafe in Chicago. There's a little like video game cafe where they sell coffee, and it's super fun hipstery cafe. But
can't anything just do one thing anymore?
Nope. There's a TV in the back, and they have a bunch of video games, and they had Battletoads.
Nice.
And we played it.
Like the coin op?
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It was the Nintendo, NES.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It was the NES. And,
did you have to blow in the cartridge to get it to work?
someone had already done that because it was clean.
That's the one thing that all people that ever played with a Nintendo 8-bit, like, we all have that as a universal. Yeah, it's different too. Like, his was a quick blow. Yep. Yours is like
one
a little
side to side, like a harmonica.
Yeah. Jonah cupped the balls.
There's some weird.
Yeah. Oh, I would just go. Like that.
Oh, like a harmonica.
Yeah, it'd be a harmonica.
My friend, like, he actually broke out the Q-tips and
rubbing alcohol.
Yeah, yeah, and he would actually get in there. And
but then, I remember my friend, he's like, works every time, and it keeps it good for a while, but then, like, everyone's like, no, but it harms it. I remember people saying
so you
got to
do the compressed air. Yeah.
And then there was also, like, you know, like ka-chunking it in to the actual player.
Yeah, there's technique for that, too. Yeah, like how you
almost push it all the way in, and then you just kind of push it down and then in.
To it.
Yeah. Yep.
They finally made like a new one that you actually insert the cartridge into the top. Yeah, yeah. It's actually foolproof. Yeah. But
actually,
like,
they made that one like still in the 90s. Like the little top.
Geek should make a toaster that you put the bread in like that and then push it down that way.
And it doesn't function unless you blow it first. Yeah. It's got like a breathalyzer you have to blow into it first.
Someone must have modded like a Dreamcast or something.
To be a toaster? I'm sure, but I want the Nintendo. I want to open the door, put my bagel in, and then push it
down. You
know
what makes a great toaster is the original Xbox. It's like you just lay your toast on there.
It has the.
You don't have to mod it at all.
You can actually make entire meals.
You just plug it in.
You can bake four potatoes at a time.
Absolutely.
On it.
You turn into a creperie, just like, oh.
Listen, get that, the tinfoil with the hot dog.
That G5 processor really sucked.
So, looking ahead, is it exciting when you see PS4, Xbox One?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay, good. So you guys aren't like, fuck, we got to start all over again and figure out this whole other
platform. Like, we dream for this moment. We've been so hyped. We've been looking forward to it. And, they've both announced now, so like we've been fortunate enough to have been trusted by these guys, so we've been able to play. We've had some time with the hardware. We're able to influence it a bit. And
yeah,
man, it's just fuck. It's so cool. Both these guys are. It's an amazing race too because they both have such amazing devices.
Yeah,
you know, I think I know a little bit about what's going on beyond what the announcements are, so I'm not going to comment on what people thought about how each one did in their announcements or anything like that. But in terms of the raw hardware, like I really like some aspects of the PS4 architecture, and that's a really nice machine, especially when you contemplate what, you know, the price point's likely to be. It's badass. And then, you know, some of the things that Microsoft's attempting and what they're actually succeeding on with the software and it's. Man, I'm thrilled.
But
as fuck.
Does that change DLC plans when you go, well, this isn't going to be backwards compatible, so does it make sense to continue this one title on this platform that's not going to be?
I mean, there's always idiosyncrasies that happen with a transition, right? Like the tail of your game on a current platform, and when, you know, do you move it forward? Do you port it to the next gen? Do you just keep supporting it? Like, I think it's going to work itself out. I mean, in our case especially, you know, we launched. We're not launching any new full products for the current gen. So we've launched the last of our current gen products, and everything we've got in development is for next gen. We have some things that we're supporting for current gen and new, like there'll be DLC for both of our most recent games for the current gen that's still to come. And the reality is, you know, at launch, you know, even if these guys do amazing at launch, what are they really going to sell? A couple million units a piece at launch, right? So, like, meanwhile, there's still a lot of machines of PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 out
there.
Well,
if I get an Xbox One, it's not like I'm going to be like, I'm going to chuck the old one. Like, I'll still hang on to that one.
Yeah, I still have my, like, Atari C380 Pong machine, you know, like, so, you know, I mean, some of us are, you know, we just can't get rid of our stuff, but we're hoarders. I'm a digital hoarder.
Is there anything, well, I always love going to, you know, at E3, there's always a booth, which is all the old.
Yeah, the Video Game History Museum. We sponsor those guys.
Like, was it Volcom? What was the... There was one that was basically just like a little terminal. It was like a black and white.
The Vectrex.
I've
got one in my office.
You have a Vectrex?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, that's
awesome. If you ever, like, in my office, I have, my wife was like, hey, dude, you got to get all the fucking old shit out of the garage. Like, we're running out of space. I'm like, all right. So I, like, made a museum in my office. So I have, like, all my consoles throughout the ages on display. And, like, I don't have everything, but I've got, like, most of.
Do you have an Intellivision?
Yeah.
Well, we had one of those.
Yeah.
TurboGrafx-16?
Absolutely. I love that.
Do you have a Sega Nomad?
I do. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
God damn.
I have. There's like somebody came and was like, I don't see an Americom. I'm like, what the fuck's an Americom? Like, but like I have pretty much every major console that ever was launched.
Wow.
Very fortunate.
You know, as we're sort of winding this down, is there anything you can hint or leak out or not fluid?
You want me to tell you something that's never been told before?
Yes. We don't have to.
About the next generation.
No one's ever done that, right? No one's ever asked that.
About the next generation. About our
or
games.
Anything.
Or
you know,
like,
if there's anything fun that you want to share.
Man.
A lot of pressure.
You know, I'm not supposed to do that. Like, okay, so one thing this is on the simple side. Maybe I'll take a bigger risk after I do this one, but we did a season pass for Borderlands 2, and the season pass was like, hey, if you buy the season pass, we're going to be doing 4 campaign DLCs, but you only have to you can get all 4 of them for the price of 3 if you buy up front, right? So everyone has this expectation that those will be the 4 DLCs, and then that's it. We're going to do more. We're going to do some other things. We don't have details yet about exactly, like, I'm not ready to announce what other things are, but when this next... the 4th campaign DLC comes out. It's called Tiny Tina's Assault on Dragon's Keep, and I think it comes out near the end of June, like June 20 something. That won't be the end of it. Like, we've got more stuff in the hopper that we're planning and getting pretty excited about. So if you are a Borderlands fan, you don't have to be afraid that that's the end of it. So that's probably less risky, but there has been some confusion. A lot of people have assumed, and we get mail all the time, like, is that going to be it? You know, tear.
It's hard. It's a real bummer when you connect with the game and then it's done.
We've built a hobby, you know, and it's awesome. Like you know, you're talking about Chloe, like Christy, you know, my wife, she is fucking nuts addicted to Borderlands 2. Like she has got 59 out of 59 achievements on the Xbox version. She's got like two level 61 characters on the PC version. She's got multiple characters where she's completed the campaign on the PS3. Like she has consumed the living
shit. Where's the time for Randy?
Yeah, I know, right? No, but she's amazing. And I mean, she's better than me, but she I married way out of my league, so I'm pretty psyched. But
the American dream.
Yeah, but she's she loves the game, which is
you're at a table of guys who are way out of their league anyway.
I don't want to.
Hey, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
High five.
Yeah.
Woo. Fake high five sound.
Fake five. Yeah.
All right. There we go. Oh. Boner farts.
You're just doing the Friends theme.
Gonna finish first. Oh.
So like I don't want to let her down, so we got to keep going.
Of course, that's you know what that is actually kind of a. It does become that personal because the people that you care about, you want them to be proud of what you're doing. So it can be as simple as like I don't want to let my lady down.
I'll give you something.
Yes,
we are building an original IP for the next generation that we'll announce sometime later. But we're creating we have. You know, Borderlands, we've got Brothers in Arms, we've got Duke Nukem, and we acquired Homeworld recently.
Yeah.
And so we have all of those great brands, but we're actually creating some new things that we'll announce.
Randy Pitchford hits an original IP, which may be out soon.
So that'll be something to look forward to.
On November 17th.
Don't ever say the date!
That was not me.
That was not Randy.
Someone else. That's going to be a story now. Yeah. You promised! It's November 17th.
That was Jonah.
We broke down the audio, and it's clearly you.
I'm in trouble.
You just had the Ghost Hunters guys do it because they're so bad at it. It's obviously Randy.
It's super low frequency.
I want to give you more, but it's not really my place to.
No, I understand.
Share things, especially with respect to the first parties. You know?
Yes, of course. You have a team.
Microsoft should have their narrative, and Sony should have their narrative.
No, it's nice that you said what you said.
They're great partners, and I would never wish to cause any of them any harm by talking about information they've entrusted us with.
Can I pitch something for a game, which I'm sure no one ever does?
Sure.
Like just an element of a game, just one sort of puzzle in a room, which is essentially a three-dimensional version of Minesweeper, which is basically basically like a three-dimensional version of Minesweeper, where you're in a room and then you have to uncover where all the bombs are by, like, you get little clues that tell you, like, within how many cells
so
you are.
So it's like an FPS that you walk around in or Minecraft
it's,
or something?
No,
or,
it's just one.
Or is it like 3D chess, which sucked, right? Like,
right. No, it's just one puzzle. It's not even a whole game around it, but it's just
how
one puzzle.
How about just a room in a game? Like, you go into some room, it's like an Easter egg. You go in a room and then it's a Minesweeper.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you just make it so, like, the room has tiles?
Is this the last
you
game
you
played?
Spell Jehovah.
Sure. It's brand that hot new game, Minesweeper.
Hot shit, man. I actually played. I have a Windows phone. I got a Windows 8 phone, and I played Minesweeper. I'm like, oh, there's achievements because it's now an Xbox Live thing.
Oh,
so
shit.
I played the shit out of.
See, who the fuck is making fun of Minesweeper now, Randy Pitchford?
Exactly. So I apologize.
It's simple but fun.
I will throw myself under the bus. I should not throw stones.
That's all right. I appreciate that. It's good to see you, man. I really appreciate you coming out and doing the
show.
I'm
happy to do it. I'm really glad. It was really fortunate. I did something for some, I guess, friends of yours yesterday, and then I've got a couple other things. So it was really awesome that I was able to come out and do this.
But,
you guys are a lot of fun. This was cool.
Oh. Well, whenever we come perform in Texas, I hope we can pop by.
I'm sure that happens all the time.
And wreak some havoc.
Yeah, no, if you are in Texas, you're welcome to come by the studio, and we'll give you a warm welcome.
Sweet. I'll be there in July. I'll see you then.
Right.
Enjoy a burrito, everybody.
July is the worst possible time
you're welcome.
To come to Texas.
Yay! Heat stroke. Woo!
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by LegalZoom.com. Whatever your legal document needs, LLCs, wills, trusts, trademarks, and more, they've got it. Over 12 years and 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom. Start your business or protect your family today at LegalZoom.com using the offer code Nerdist.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
all of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.